funny shit that took me a long time to get here.
Both players have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both more keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their asses for 10 years.
All right, so we got the news we were waiting for, lads. The GAA have confirmed that there's going to be no... Well, the season's not starting in May, like it was, you know, scheduled for. But sure, we all knew that anyways. And it was Alan Milton I was listening to on the news the other night saying July at the earliest, and that makes sense. That's kind of what we were predicting. And there's a Congress this Friday, a remote Congress, so the delegates can pretty much do anything they want now. They're at home in their own house voting with nobody
no
near
transparency.
Them. Definitely no transparency here. But like, I mean, they're going to give the GAA management committee the power to, you know, roll with the punches here and, you know, make the changes necessary, Conan, as we're going along.
Yeah, I'm sort of, to be honest, just giving up on a season at this stage. Like, just seeing like what they're talking about in America and the stuff they're proposing the Premier League and how the lengths that they'd have to go to make a tournament happen behind closed doors, even, because like every single person who plays and contributes to that event, who reports on it, like they'd all have to be in isolation together. And then once you step back outside that, then you put everything on hold again for another 2 weeks and you have to do more tests. And I just don't see how you can do that with a GAA. Like, at least the Premier League, you have the carrot of, well, like, we'll pay you for it. Just stay away from your family for a few months and just everybody stay here together. But the GAA, I just don't see how that happens. And also, if it's behind closed doors, what's the point really for the GAA? You know, unless everything dramatically improves, but like, if there's no money being made from gate receipts, then the GAA, I'm sure they won't be rushing to put people at risk like that.
I think he's right, Connor, on the behind closed doors. Patrick Horgan was talking about that, and he's talking about playing in an empty stadium wouldn't be too exciting, even for clubs with no one in the grounds. It would be hard. He says there's the buzz of it. It keeps you on edge all week, getting up against great players there for everyone to see. Now, it would be on television. It would put you on an edge and get you nervous. That's what we play for. Being able to hear the ball coming off the hurley around the stadium wouldn't be too good. And I do understand that paid professionals might need to play in front of empty stadiums. GAA is amateur. It's a community-based organisation. Without the fans, you know, what is it really? So I would like to see it go ahead in empty stadiums rather than have nothing at all. But I could see if the GAA aren't going to make money out of it, where's the motivation to go behind closed doors?
Well, that's the ultimate question. What do you prefer? Do you prefer GAA in front of crowds, or do you prefer, you know, would you prefer, you know, the GAA not going ahead at all, or would you prefer it in front of behind closed doors? Like, I think that we have to be careful what we wish for in terms of that. Like last week, I was thinking, right, okay, if there's even some sort of return, even if it's behind closed doors and we can see it on TV, I think we'd be happy with that. But like, how often have we talked about here, and even as far into a competition as the Super 8s, where there might be a game in Croke Park that might have 30,000 people at it, and it's just because the stadium isn't full and because, you know, there's such a lack of atmosphere, it's kind of an anti-climax.
You're right.
That's the thing. So while we're now thinking, geez, listen, I'd watch, you know, three lads doing a drill in a field just to get my fix of GAA. I think that the prospect of actually behind closed doors, while it might sound okay, you know, as something acceptable for the time being, I'd say once we're in the middle of it, we might quickly grow tired of it.
Yeah, I could feel the analysis on the show every Monday after these matches would be, I kind of felt like a challenge match, you know, that kind of way. There's some managers and they want a date. Like Kieran Kingston has been on saying, this is probably why the GAA had to release this statement and let people know what the story was. They're actually interesting that the GAA are going to finish out the Alliance Leagues. And I was seeing somebody suggesting that they should finish the Alliance Leagues next year instead of the preseason competition. So at least we'll know what the league standings are for the tier two and all everything that goes along with that. Maybe that might be a bit too late. But Kieran Kingston is saying the one thing that will be helpful to guys that are training on their own and you're asking them to be self-motivated, they need some sort of a deadline. And Declan Bonner has been saying the same thing. He said if the GAA could set up a provisional date so that we could start planning accordingly. Our backroom teams can then start to taper training to a particular date, and even if that doesn't happen, at least the players will have had positive targets to work towards. I can see where they're coming from, but why would the managers not set them a date if they're so desperate for a date to motivate them? Like, I mean, the reality is players aren't stupid, Conan, and like you're going to, the GAA come out and say, right, July 1st we're starting, and then that's cancelled. Like, I mean, it's madness that the GAA would suggest a date ahead of medical advice. And then on the other hand, I can see where managers kind of are coming from. They're probably kind of a bit sick of being in no man's land.
Ah, yeah, they'd be hammered either way. Imagine they said July 1st and then Leo Varadkar stands up on June 28th and says, we're extending it for another 3 weeks, and then we're all hammering the GAA for suggesting that. We'd be hammering them beforehand as well, as you say, for jumping ahead of medical advice. And like, what can you do? Their hands are tied. We've all been told things are off for another 3 weeks. We know it's going to be longer. But like, you know, they can't just go ahead now and speculate that we're going to put on a firm date for October. And like, that's probably the best way. Like the league, I think we have to forget about that. Like, there's already precedent. That's the good news with club teams. Like, remember the Galway Hurling final? Was it in 2018? They played the 2015 Hurling League final or something like that. Yeah. So it's not something that people aren't used to. But yeah, in terms of giving the date, like, that's probably the only way. Like, managers just give people targets. Like, because at this rate, it's going to be a knockout at the end of the year, if anything. So they don't need to be told July or anything.
That's the thing. I'm sure players are definitely struggling with motivation. There's no doubt about that. But there's no one stopping a manager saying, look, because listen, everybody's opinion, like, there's no one has the right answer to this. So if a manager wants to go into WhatsApp group and say, look, lads, I was reading an article there, we're going to be getting going on July the 1st. I want you primed for then. Like, work away. There's nobody stopping them doing that. It's just the GAA aren't going to commit to that, Connor.
Well, a management team setting a date is as good as the GAA setting one, because they're both, as Conan said, their hands are tied by the government and how they'd react based on public advice, based on advice from the public health team. And like, there's no sign anywhere at the moment. And it's not just Ireland, like even countries that are far ahead of, like I was reading recently that New Zealand are considering a return to rugby, but there's only been like 9 deaths, I think, in New Zealand. They've handled it really well. So, but they haven't even factored in how that might come about yet. And they're at a far more advanced level than we are in terms of dealing with the virus. So setting a date, it's kind of nearly a pointless exercise. Like, I can absolutely understand where they're coming from in terms of all players have to do now is set themselves. All they can do is maintain their personal fitness, and to a certain degree, their skill level is doing whatever they can do. So they've no goal to aim for. Like, managers can't be shouting in their ears about a day, like a championship date down the line that they have to aim for. But no more than everybody else, they just have to be patient. Like, people are starting to get a bit itchy now, because especially before the Easter weekend, the deadline was extended by 3 weeks. But that's like, all we can do is wait on guidance from the Department of Health and the government, etc. So like setting a date, to me, seems a bit of a pointless exercise at the moment.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. So season ticket holders aren't going to get refunds. That's in the small print. John Fogarty had this. It says in the small print that in the event of the GAA season, National League or Championship being postponed due to circumstances outside the control of the GAA, that being a natural disaster or a pandemic, there will be no refunds available for GAA season ticket holders. So, geez, they have themselves well covered for a pandemic like this happening. So, like, I mean, some people will get kind of stung for that, because season tickets are £120. That gets into league games and the first championship game, plus All-Ireland club finals. For £200, then you can get the club plus option, and that gets you entry into all club games. And then there's a €300 Ulster club plus one, which includes county club and Dr. McKenna Cup, and then under 17, under 20 fixtures, all that kind of thing. So if you're an absolute diehard lunatic that spent £300 on your season ticket holders up in Ulster, Conan, you might be a little bit pissed off, but I suppose there's a bigger picture here, right? We have to keep giving that context.
Yeah, but that is the shame. Like, it is the diehard lunatics who are unfortunately going to be stung by it. Like, you know, the ones who probably deserve it most or don't deserve it most. And it's really tough on them. Like, the GAA have themselves covered, but it's a shame in that, you know, they're not going to be putting any money into organising a competition. So they're just sort of getting this money as a bonus. So it would be nice if next year came along, or like, you know, further down the line or whatever, they can just give these people who have already bought a season ticket some sort of subsidy. Like, it just seems a bit tough on them that they'll have bought season tickets for games that they're not going to see all year.
Yeah, exactly. Talking about diehards, we have David Brady, Alan Brogan and Johnny Doyle, they're ringing old people who are cocooning all over the country. And Alan Brogan joins us on the line now. Alan, you're a glutton for punishment.
Hey, Ollie. look, I saw the tweet from David on I think it was Saturday. And I thought, that's a nice idea. And like, obviously it is. I'm here in the house with my wife and my three kids, so there's plenty to keep me occupied. But when I thought about what maybe old people, and particularly old people on their own, are going through, it is a very difficult time. And I suppose I threw the tweet out there, and I got lots of responses back, which was nice. So I'm making my way through them. I probably made about 18 or 20 phone calls at this stage, and some very interesting phone calls. Some it's just a quick hello, a few minutes on the phone. But everyone, to be fair, has been very happy to receive the call and been very thankful, which is nice, I suppose. But I spoke to a couple of, I spoke to a man up, and he's living up in West Cavan on his own. He's from Clanliffe, lived in Dublin until he was 65 or 66, and then he moved up there with his wife, and his wife passed away. So he's up there on his own. His son's got to visit him with field and stuff, but he's out in the country on his own. So I suppose for a fellow like him to receive the call, and he probably knew more about Dublin football than I did now, tell me about the All-Ireland of 55 and 58. And so it's been a bit of a history lesson for me as well.
Very good. And are they expecting the call off you, or are some of them surprised?
Most of them have been surprised, I think. That was nice. Like how I did it was, I received messages mostly off their children, or maybe off a grandchild or something. Would you give my granny a call, or would you give my dad a call? And I just sent a DM on Twitter to get the details. Some gave me lots of details about what their dad and mom had kind of done, who they'd been involved in, and that sort of thing. So I was able to use that to form the basis of a conversation. But look, all the conversations have been good. I spoke to one gentleman who told me he was at a talk up in a club in Loud a few years ago. Kevin Heffernan was giving a talk, so he went up to hear the talk, and Kevin Heffernan was asked if he could take anyone off the existing team onto the team in the 70s, who would he take? And he said he'd take me off the existing team. This was a few years ago now, so to hear that now, I'd never heard that before, so to hear that was nice. Would have been nice to play in Heffernan's team in the 70s.
Right, and are they all Dubs, or is there Culshies looking for you to call them as well?
No, there's a few. Yeah, I spoke to a man from Longford, and a few. There were a couple of calls. Were called to me to a man up in Armagh today. So, but most have been Dubs, to be fair. But not all living in Dublin. Some moved down to Cork. That gentleman was up there, and he was up in Cavan, and somewhere over west. And I haven't got any international ones yet.
Right,
strange enough. I saw David tweeting as well, but he spoke to. Spoke to people in America, but most are Dubs, but not all living in Dublin. Maybe some that have moved away and stuff. But and to be fair, all sound in pretty good form, I think. And I'd say the weather has helped a lot of people as well. Anyone that has a back garden, if you need to get out into the old back garden. But it is kind of when you talk to someone and you hear if their husband or wife have passed away, and they can pass whatever, which lots of them obviously have, and they're kind of on their own, kind of relying on the support of family to bring food, and maybe somebody down the road to bring food. And their only contact with people is maybe out a window or out the front door, on a phone call like that. That I'm sure is tough. So look, I just thought it was a nice thing to do. It's obviously taken up a little bit of time, but it's time that I probably have in my hands at the moment, bar minding the kids at home and doing a little bit of work. So, and I suppose for myself, I thought I I'm at home, and there's obviously lots of people out there have to go to work and do their eight or their 12-hour shifts in hospitals or in supermarkets or in GP practices around the country. I'm probably lucky enough that I don't have to go out and face this thing head on. We're just told to stay at home, so I suppose if I can do a little something to help like that, it's worthwhile.
Yeah. How did the conversations go? How's it going? It's Alan Brogan here. I'm just giving you a ring. I'm sure there's dead silence on the phone for a little while then, is there?
Yeah, I kind of said when I was on Twitter with whoever had asked me to do it, I'd say, well, they know me, and all the calls come back, or all the messages come back, yeah, they'll 100% know who you are. So kind of say, look, I got a message off your son or your daughter or your grandchild or whatever, said you were at home missing the GEA on your own, and I said I'd just give you a call to make sure you're doing okay and stuff. And some of them thought it was a wind up. I spoke to a couple of Dubs, you know, real inner city Dubs, and I'll go way out of that, will you? Some of them did think it was a wind up, so I had to kind of had to go through my CV to convince him that it was the real that was the real me. But after a couple of minutes, they kind of got into the call, and look, like I said, some of the calls went on maybe. Probably the shortest call I've had is probably 5 or 6 minutes, and maybe some of them have gone on for, I'd say the longest one is probably 20, 22 minutes. So, and look, I'm obviously conscious that I've kind of committed. Once I've said to somebody you have to ring, I've committed to doing it. So you kind of take an hour, and you have an hour free, and you try to get through 4 or 5 of them, and obviously some calls take longer than others, and then if you're talking to someone, you want to be able to give them the time as well. So rather than doing 1 or 2 minute calls and hopping off and hopping on to the next one, I said, look, take the time. If somebody wants to have a chat and maybe tell me some of their stories as well, and I'm happy to lend that ear as well. And I'll get through them over the next 2 or 3 weeks. I think we've another 2.5 weeks for this anyway. So look, if I do 3 or 4 calls a day,
you get through them.
Them all out, and hopefully it'll make a little bit of a difference.
So, like, I mean, it's all right for you, Alan Brogan, calling people. Like, I mean, that's nice. Like, if I try to do that, hello, Colin Parkinson here, who the fuck is that guy?
You'd be surprised all if you did it down in Leash, like, you people love to talk to you.
Well, in Leash, I could be just hung up on, depending on what club they're from. Like, you don't know what's going on there.
Alan, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised when you come to the end of a career and stuff. I think people always, they just want to talk about GAA. They're just GAA people. Anyone that has asked me, they're pure GAA people. And I've said who I am. Some want to go back to 2011. Some want to go back to 1955, to the first All-Ireland Day, without a 58, whatever year it was. Some want to talk about when it was only Vincent's players in the Dublin team. Actually, that's come across a few times when people talk about maybe the first All-Ireland. I think it was 55, Dublin winning the All-Ireland, the 58. I'm not sure, but I think it was all Vincent. So
really?
These people were obviously 10 or 12 or 15 years old, so kind of Vincent's was the club team that everyone sort of gravitated because all the Dublin players were Vincent. Like, there might have been one other fella from Old Warriors or something like that, but it was nearly all Vincent. So even like a lot of GA people out there aren't, but especially in Dublin, aren't necessarily affiliated with clubs either. So the club, they naturally kind of gravitate towards the St. Vincent's because of and they supported Dublin when they were kids. All the lads were Vincent players, which is gone. I never really realised it either. I knew it was all Vincent, but I never realised that there kind of would have been a grow towards St. Vincent's from people from all over Dublin because of their representation on the Dublin team at the time.
Right, maybe. So, like, I mean, this is a big commitment. Do you think this could pass the 3 weeks mark, May the 5th? Like, I mean, rural isolation is a big issue. You don't know what you've signed up for here, Alan. There'll be charities looking for you.
I'm sure it'll die off a little bit now, to be fair. I've got a couple of texts, maybe people that went on Twitter and stuff heard about it. I think the Herald had something on it a couple of days ago. Yeah, but I've got a couple of text messages over the last 2 days and heard you're doing this. Would you ring this person from a couple of people in hospital and stuff, so it has grown a little bit of legs, all right. But as I said, look, I'm happy to deal with the times we're in, and obviously have a bit of spare time on my hands now at the moment because I'm at home from work and stuff. But
on May the 5th you'll have to delete that tweet.
this offer, I should have put a little asterisk, this offer stands to May the 5th only.
Yeah, there's an expiry date on this offer. Come here, you mentioned 2011, and like, I mean, we're all watching your Laoghaire Gael. Were you happy with the Laoghaire Gael, how it turned out and everything?
I was. I don't know how the bit ended up in there, but the messing against Leash back a few years ago. That must have been your influence. But it can't be all. It can't be all good. But now I was happy with it. To be fair, I think we did a very good job on it. And yeah, look, I know you're supposed to. You were coming along yourself. We were going to have a kind of a family and friends night the Friday before there, but I had to cancel it at the last minute because of the coronavirus. But I watched it at home, and yeah, I think I was happy with it. I got lots of lovely messages as well. I suppose it was nice just to sit back and have a look back over some of my achievements over the years, and to see some of the games as well. Because I've never really been one to look back at games that I've played in years. But once it's gone, it's kind of gone. So it was nice to look back over some of those memories and But I think in fairness to the lads in Nathan Dale and TG Carr, they did a very good job on it. And you did a good job yourself over as well.
Thanks for it. They do a great job on it, and I was reading an interview Oisín McConville did during the week in the Irish News, and he was asked about the All-Ireland final 2002, and Oisín McConville says, "I've never watched a full game back. I only forward to my parts." And I have to say, any time I've ever watched a match back, there's been a fair bit of forward and rewinding being done. And like with the Laker Gale, obviously it's all about you, so it's absolutely perfect. You don't have to watch any of it.
You just sit back and enjoy it. And watch when you're analysing matches, like say the week or two after, or even watch them later on, you're only interested in what you do, but you're looking for areas for yourself to improve rather than everyone improves when you're doing it on your own. So like I said, I never really was one to sit back and look back over matches. It was always on to the next one or whatever, and now I don't have the time to sit down and look back at all matches, so it was nice to take the hour and just remember some of the fun memories of that.
One thing I was surprised
about was the games against Leash and stuff where they've always said that team they played on in from 2002 to 2010 before we managed to win the All-Ireland, obviously the team that won the All-Ireland after that gets a lot of the accolades now, but that's a team I have very fond memories of, and there were some great games against the likes of Leash and Wexford and Kildare in the Leinster Championship around then with full houses in Croke Park, so it was good to look back on them too.
Yeah, no, definitely. Come here, one thing that wasn't in the show was the Alan Brogan bounce, and I'm surprised they didn't ask me about it. I should have brought it up. Where this started and how it evolved, because you did start this bounce where you take 10 steps with one bounce and hold it up in the air. Where did this come to your head?
Yeah, I don't know. It's something that evolved over time, but it only really works on hard ground in the summertime because you bounce it out far in front and you have to chase after it. But it's funny, my son is a big fan of Rory Stories, and a couple of his friends met Rory Stories a couple of months back and asked him to sign an autograph for Jamie. And he signed it, "Dear Jamie, the best of luck," or whatever. Your dad filled the whole country with that 10-yard bounce for years. And a smiley face, you know. So Jamie was asking, "What's this bounce about, Dad?" So I've been teaching him to bounce now over the last couple of months to try to get an extra few steps in and fill some referees. But yeah, look, it probably worked to my advantage a couple of times over. Maybe I did take a couple of extra steps using it over the years. But it was something that evolved. It wasn't something that evolved necessarily on purpose, but it did evolve over time. And it's something that definitely helped me on hot days in Croke Park when the ground was hard.
Yeah, well, it wasn't just the bounce. It was that you had about 4 steps in the action of the bounce. You'd hold it up for about, it would be held up in your hand for about 3 or 4 steps. And then by the time you bounce it, you could be on 6, 7 steps. And by the time you catch it, you're up to 10. It was the kind of pause in actually bouncing it.
Yeah, I generally use it when there's someone hanging on me on the other side as well before I get away from them, just hold it up there and get an extra couple of steps in. So,
like a slam dunk.
So a lot of cases, they probably would have got a free anyway.
Yeah, maybe. Right, come here. I won't keep you any longer, Alan. Fair play to what you're doing, and we'll talk to you again.
Thanks, Willie.
So yeah, the Alan Brogan bounce, lads, iconic at this stage. I've used it myself a couple of times, and it really, really does work. There's no doubt about that, Conan.
Yeah, I remember seeing it work against Sean Murray Lockhart in 2007. I thought, Jesus, it must be really good if it's working against him. He just had it all. I remember, like you said, in his Laker Gael, he was a man who was always looking for the ball and always making things happen. But I still remember after, so Derry played Dublin in the 2007 quarterfinal, and afterwards just bumping into Lockhart, and he just sort of been hinting at retiring, and it was the reason was running around after boys like Alan Brogan all day. He was getting older at that stage and thought, I can't be arsed for this nonsense. That's the effect Alan Brogan had.
Just a nightmare to mark. And one thing that struck me about the Laker Gael, I kind of knew it anyways, but it was painted out. 2011 Player of the Year, 2012 injury, and never really recovers from the injury. Like to go from Player of the Year to retiring in 15. Just in and out and in and out through injury, and to go to such a height, and it was such a kind of a fall then really after that.
Yeah, but just watching back the Alan Brogan Laker Gael particularly just reminded me there of the game that obviously took my attention was the 2006 semi-final against Mayo. And look, like the job he did on, as good as, like, Keith Higgins mightn't have been established as he was, let's say, later in his career, but the job that Alan Brogan did on Keith Higgins that day, it was phenomenal stuff. Alan Brogan couldn't miss, and he was probably the best player on the pitch, but that was kind of overlooked because Mayo won the game. But that's right. And Alan Brogan told a great story actually about in the league regale about, I think he was dropped for the semi-final, was he? And I think he was told just beforehand. It was just
Dermot Connolly and Keegan were suspended, and Connolly got off at the last minute, and Alan had been brought in instead of Connolly, and then Connolly got the reprieve the night before.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. But it was just interesting to hear, like, somebody who would be so used to starting as Alan Brogan, for example, and have to deal then with just being told, you know, as a result of the Connolly getting the reprieve that he wasn't playing. But, like, to be fair to him, like, it was just because of what happened, because of the circumstances of his career after 2011, it was brilliant that he ended up on that high in the 2015 final. And just speaking about that hop that you're on, the Alan Brogan bounce that you're on about earlier on, he utilised it fairly well in that score with the 1-2 with Bernard at the end against Kerry too. It's great to see.
Yeah, you know, he definitely did. What do you make of the Laoghaire Gaels lads going for the likes of David Brady now and Diarmaid Ling, like players who are not iconic players as in what they've won, or, you know, their careers weren't necessarily stellar, but Diarmaid Ling would have a nice little life story. David Brady doesn't really have a life story. I don't know why. I'm not really sure why he got picked. But, you know, they seem to be moving away from maybe having to have won 5 All-Irelands or the big players or like that, Conan. What do you think of that? Like, I kind of, in my head, if they were to ring me, I'd actually say, geez, I don't think so. You know what I mean? I don't know, but you wouldn't. I don't think I would. I don't think I'd be like, why? Alan Brogan and Kieran Donaghy were just on this season. Like, think of the players who have done it. I wouldn't feel worthy of going on it.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I was actually just getting excited for you when I saw those names. Just thinking, geez, Thomas Morgan won't be far away from this. But you're right. Like, I think Anthony Toole's the only one who's done it in Derry. So, like, that's the level that it's at in my head. And we see McDonald or Matt. It's just, it has to be the best of the best, I think, and there's still loads of those out there. Right? They haven't gone through all of them. Like, so, yeah, like, maybe it's, I know it's hard to put the show together and to do it way in advance, but it seems like they, you know, could maybe just be going at the top still. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. You see, they moved it out from a half an hour to an hour, so they like to bring in a little bit of a life story into it, and that's one thing Alan had reservations about, because he's like just being honest. Look, I'm just a normal fella. I don't have any kind of back life story, you know, to fill up the rest, the other part of the hour. So I think maybe they're under a little bit of pressure of bringing, you know, separating some football with some kind of stuff that happened in your life, maybe, or, you know, more of a TV program.
I think that's it. Like, I think previously Laoghaire Gael was basically, you'd be sure that whoever was the subject would be showing the highlights of a match and maybe talk about that and little bits of their career. But there was very little kind of insight from, let's say, out, like, off the pitch kind of thing. Whereas the David Brady one, the majority of insight, probably necessarily so, was off the pitch. He was down at his old primary school. He was on about fishing. He was on about his ventriloquist act when he was down in Australia, which I'd never heard of before. So if nothing else, I learned that from the David Brady. But maybe it's a case, as Conan said, that there, and, like, you know, there could be reticence on behalf of the people who, you know, who have won all the medals. They mightn't fancy that kind of, you know, being the subject of a program for an hour long. As you said, like Alan Brogan said, he's just a normal fella, doesn't want that kind of insight into his life off the pitch. But the more than Conan, I was getting a little bit excited that they're going for more characters now. So I thought they might give you a shout. But if you've no interest, well, then
I would be embarrassed to go on that. Like, I mean, the one thing about Gizzy Ling was a class player, like, and he would have been, you know, maybe achieved similar to me, like, not, you know, not being a big player and kind of quit early and all these kind of things. David Brady was a very limited player. He wasn't even a top notch player, you know, and was on and off the team towards the end. So I don't know how he would have agreed to do it. You know, I honestly would say, I'm sorry, I would be too embarrassed to do something like that. And then you had David Brady tweeting during a pandemic about the county board not promoting his bloody show. Like, I mean, where's this fella's head at?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, even the way it's set up, like, it's usually, like, it, we're talking about it being the top players, it's set up that way so then all the people on talking, like you were for Alan Brogan, are talking about this player and such stature, like, and what he brought to the team and him being so important. Like, it's going to get harder if they're stepping on down the ladder a bit.
Yeah, maybe it's just going to be more of an entertainment show or something like that, but I think they would lose out by that, because what I like about that show is legends of the game and other opponents they've played, given little bits and pieces on them and back onto games. And I think they might lose that if they move too far away, from that. Another one, lads, before we take a break, was Mark Poland did an interview in the Irish News. And he was talking about the 2010 semi-final against Kildare. And he said when her bus pulled up in Croke Park that day underneath the Hogan stand, before James McCartan let us off the bus, he played audio of all the voices of the GAA analysts and pundits, and all of them tipped Kildare. Number one, like, there's a little element of sports psychology to that. And look, we've been written off. We've all heard that one. Like, you know, whoever put together all the... For some reason, people really get the hump about not being tipped to win a match. Do you know what I mean? And we're the underdogs. And maybe that got their back up a bit. But this was accompanied by Florence and the Machine song called You Got the Love. And he said, it sent shivers down my spine, Mark Poland said. And he said, even now when I hear that song on the radio, it always takes me back to that day. Now, I can understand, Colin, the sports psychology around playing the pundits. But what has Florence of the Machine, You Got the Love, got to do with any kind of football song? Like, who chose this music? And how is this in any way related to what the pundits kind of tipping against your team?
It's a good song, though, Willie. It's a good, like, you know, a bit of music can really make any program, I think, never mind any sort of quotes that are writing you off. I don't know, I could definitely see the value of it. Like, I can hear that song as well and think, geez, I would, like, you know, you probably remember songs he played in the dressing room that maybe accompanied a manager's speech or something like that. And
I remember a lot of lads used to play that Eminem, Lose Yourself in the Music, you know, you're getting ready for battle and all that kind of carry on. I remember that being a little bit of a thing players listen to. But Florence and the Machine, this is a new one of me, You Got the Love.
Somebody had Gerry Cinnamon on for our game before Ballyboden this year. We might think get hammered.
didn't Liam Griffin play Braveheart before the 96 final, I think, for Wexford, as far as I know. And I think he might have stopped it before the end. Spoiler alert for William Wallace, maker. Yeah, I think so, yeah. But, like, do you know, one thing I was glad of, Willie, was that somebody has a story to tell that doesn't involve the Inches speech from any given Sunday.
Yeah.
While it seemed like 99% of teams were using that.
Well, Armagh, of course, made that one famous. They went on record saying that they listened to that in 2002, and then every match we used to go to under Mick O'Dwyer, we used to that speech would be playing on the bus. So it's like, oh my god, get a little bit of originality. But anyways, listen, lads, we'll leave it there for part one and we'll be back in a second, and in the meantime you can enjoy a bit of Florence. Sometimes I feel like throw my hands up in the air, I know I can count on you. Sometimes I feel like saying, Lord, I just don't care, but you got the love I need to see me through. Sometimes it seems the going is just too rough. Everything's gone wrong no matter what I do. Now and then it seems like life is just too much, but you got the love I need to see me through. When food is gone. All right, so the news broke this week that Johnny Glynn got the coronavirus over in New York. And it was funny because I texted him last week asking him to come on the show because we know how bad the situation is in New York, and kind of his name jumped into my head and he didn't reply back. And then I read that this week and I texted him and apologized and said, look, I really didn't know you had it or whatever. He says, no problem, grand. He's back normal again. But he was on the Long Haul podcast recently and he said there was one, this is just pure Johnny Glynn summarizing what the coronavirus is like. Nobody else could describe it like Johnny Glynn. There was one night, this is Johnny Glynn speaking now, there was one night I woke up at 2 a.m. and it felt like I was after getting hit with a sledge in the middle of my back. So that's it. If anybody wants to know what it's like a sledge in the middle of your back. And he said that was the main symptom he had, but he's back all right now again. So, like, I mean, I suppose there'd be more cases of this, different players getting it. Not too many so far, has there been, Connor?
No, not that I've seen, I suppose, and maybe like GA players mightn't be the most at risk category compared to some others. But it was just when I heard I was reading Johnny Glynn describe his symptoms there on, and I was listening to it in the voice that you interviewed him. I think it was the morning after Galway won the All Ireland. It was just pure classic Johnny Glynn saying he could barely walk to the toilet. It was just like as a kind of side note to that as well. It was just interesting to hear him say that his Galway career could be over. He thinks that he's only 26 and he said he's nearly drawn the line. Now, that's not because of the coronavirus, just the more that he's likely to remain in New York for the time being. But it was just considering he is such a character and such a brilliant player, it'd be a shame that that it might be the last we've seen of him in a Galway jersey.
Yeah, no, definitely. One other hurler that got the coronavirus is our very own Michael Carton, and he joins us on the line now. How are you feeling now, Michael?
Hey, Willie, it's great to be back. Back to a bit of normality. Thank God. Yeah. Took a while.
And how long did it take in total, I suppose, from start to finish?
Oh, it's about 2.5 weeks. Because when I start showing the symptoms, like I suppose mine started with a headache and then I start getting sore on my arms and legs and like sort of like flu-like symptoms. But I had no sore throat or anything, so I didn't think too much of it. But then after about 4 days, the headaches were getting worse in particular. And then I started getting a bit of a temperature. So I got tested and tested positive. So like before you even test positive, you have it 4 days, 5 days maybe. So
right,
it's a long enough field process.
Right. Okay. And like, I mean, what happened then how did you end up testing positive? Did you go through a drive-through? How did you get the test? How did that happen?
Yeah, well, with work, we have, like, it's Corporate Health Ireland, it's called, and we have to get in contact with them because obviously you don't want to be going in on the fire truck or ambulance if you think you've any symptoms. So I got in contact with them, and they told me to drive to Navan Hospital because it goes through where you live, and I live in Meath. So they asked me, could I be in Navan Hospital within the hour? So I said, absolutely. So I drove over, and you sit out in the car park and a team come out with about five people all gowned up and take you in from the car. So a little embarrassing, but had to be done. And I at that stage, I wasn't too sure if I would test positive or not, but
yeah,
I had the results in 24 hours because I suppose it happened to me early enough, so I didn't have to wait too long. And 24 hours later, they rang me and said, you tested positive. And there's right, an ambulance on the way.
Jeez, and so they send an ambulance. See, I suppose in a way you were lucky that you were so early in the whole thing that there was a hospital bed for you. The test only took 24 hours. The people right now are experiencing a different situation altogether.
Yeah, she's speaking to lads now. They're waiting a week, like since 7-8 days, even longer. And by that stage, you're self-isolating and you're at home. And I suppose once you start showing the symptoms, they want you being 14 days, and on the 14th day, if you're symptom-free, they're giving you the all clear. But because I was so early on, yeah, they sent an ambulance, and I would have stayed at home, to be honest, but they sent an ambulance. And I was pretty lucky, I think, because I got sicker then, and I probably would have ended up in hospital anyway.
Right.
To be honest.
So how sick did you get?
I caught a bad dose. Like,
how bad did it get?
For me, I couldn't get out of bed. I was constantly nauseous, headaches, couldn't stop shaking with the temperature. And they were all, you feel miserable with that, but my chest x-ray was quite bad. Like you said, it was quite vicious. And I had a bad infection in my lungs, which I didn't know because I had no cough and I had no shortness of breath, but my oxygen levels were very low and they couldn't get them up for, say, 5 days, 4 or 5 days. And that was with me being on oxygen in the hospital. So,
right.
I think that was the main concern for them. So I went through about 6 days in the hospital where I felt really bad. I couldn't get out of the hospital, couldn't get out of bed and couldn't move. And then I'd say on the 7th day then, I turned a corner, my oxygen levels came up and started improving from there.
Right. And what's your appetite like with it? Like, I mean, can you eat or are you losing weight badly or...?
I never lost like a sense of my taste or smell, but I couldn't eat because I was so nauseous. So right. I was lying in bed and they come in with the food and then they take away the food an hour later and I didn't touch anything for 5 days.
Jesus.
It was the worst diet I've ever been on. so about 5 days solid, I couldn't physically eat. Just I felt so sick. And they're giving you medication in there, and because you have nothing in your stomach, It's very hard to say. Like, some of the medication is rough enough to take. And the other way they'd say they want you eating something while taking this medication, but sure, I couldn't do that because I was so nauseous. So just for 5 days, really, just later, taking whatever medication they could give me and trying to keep it down.
Right.
I knew myself one morning I woke up and I was hungry. And I was like, oh, God, that's the first time I've been hungry in 6 days, 6-7 days.
Right. So, like,
I couldn't wait for the toast to come in.
So, like, I mean, you're sitting in hospital. No family can can come and visit you. You're desperately sick. Like, I mean, what are you, is thoughts going through your head about of dying in there?
Yeah, well, not dying, but it's more frightening to think, like, if it does get worse, it would be awful. It would be such a lonely place to be because nobody can come see you. Like, your family, if it does get that way, your family can't say goodbye unless it's over the phone or on the other side of a door.
Yeah.
They can't come in and there'd be no contact that way. And you sort of say to yourself, you wish some people would think about that before they go out in big gatherings. And because it's an awful way, it would be an awful way to go, not being able to say goodbye to your family. So obviously you have nothing but time to think in there. So you're making all these, I'm going to be fitter than ever now when I leave, and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, because that's all you can do when you're in there. So it was great then to finally turn the corner. But that's one thing people have to remember. Like, just if it does happen to a family member, it's quite a tough place to be if you're going to get sick and go to ICU or something, because you can't see them, you can't visit them.
Yeah. And are there other cases around you in hospital, like in pain, or I suppose you were early in the timeline?
Yeah, well, see, because you're isolated, I was brought into sort of basement of the matter. You're brought straight into an isolation room, so you don't see any other patients.
Right.
And it's only through talking to the nurses, they said that the ward was full, and it was full of a lot of mid-30 age group. Like, you don't get to see the patients because you're obviously inside your room. You're not allowed to leave for them 2 weeks or whatever you're in there. But it's just through speaking to the nurse, they said, yeah, so many, like, mid-30s men and women in there, and they're struggling, like, you know. So, like, the myth out there that's only the elderly are sick, like, none of us had underlying conditions who were in there at the time. So that's one of the frightening things,
right?
Could be affected and not be sick.
Were all the hospital staff wearing the protective gear, because we know there's a shortage of that at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. But the ward I was in the matter was only for coronavirus cases. So any nurses or doctors or catering staff that come near you are all fully gowned up. They come in, do their tests, and then leave. So it's a little bit surreal. It doesn't really even feel like real contact, because from head to toe, they're in protective gear, which they obviously have to be in. So for that minimal contact you get for the day, they're in and out pretty quick when they have their tests done, which you'd expect because it's such a hazardous environment. So it's a very tough place to work for the staff.
Yeah,
definitely, because they're putting themselves at risk every time they come into the room with a patient. So they're fully gowned up and then leave and wash up and leave. And if they've been every single time they come into you, they've been everything they're wearing. So you can see why they're going through so much gear, so much equipment.
All right. Like, I mean, really, even when they leave your room to go into another one, they need full new gear.
So head-to-toe visors, masks, goggles, full apron, two pairs of gloves, all have to be binned every time they come into me, and then they put them on for the next patient. And that's for a nurse or doctor, and sometimes you've got two people in the room with you.
Jeez, I didn't realise that, but like, the other patient would have it as well, so I don't want to make light.
Yeah, so like, I think at the time there was 14 to 18 people on the ward I was on, so like, that's every time a nurse or doctor is doing a round, they're going into them patients, and then robing up and then binning everything and then doing it all over again. So you can see why you're flying through the equipment. That's only on one ward.
Wow. Jeez, I didn't realise that. So, that's mad, huh?
Yeah. So it's incredible the amount of resources you need just to keep the place running.
Come here, one thing I was wondering about is when you get the test results back, when do you do the tracing? Were you too sick to do the tracing at the start, or do you do the tracing when you start feeling better? And how hard is it to remember, you know, back to 14 days or whatever they tried to go back?
Yeah, so they left me, I went in the hospital on the Saturday day. I got into hospital at 11 o'clock at night. I was quite sick then for a day or two. They rang me 2 days later, a public health doctor, and just said, look, we're going to do the tracing, but we'll ring back in, say, 3 hours. Could you do a list of everyone you've been in contact with for the last 2 weeks? And so I sat there in the bed and did my list. And I wasn't too many places in the 2 weeks, so I think I got nearly everywhere. And then they got in contact with everyone I mentioned. And then they were isolating for 2 weeks. I was with all my family and all Kira's family for that week. I was sick, so I was that was my main concern in the hospital for the first 6 days, just saying, oh God, I hope, like, if it does, if it, this, if I'm this bad, I hope my mom and dad or her mom and dad didn't get it.
Yeah. And did anyone get it?
Here, all my brothers and family. No one. Absolutely no one.
Right.
That was blessed. And when I say no one, they'd be all isolated for the 2 weeks, but some of them could have had it and just not been symptomatic.
I get you.
That's happened.
Yeah.
But because they all isolated for the 2 weeks and none of them had any symptoms, so I was delighted then after that, because it can take a few days to show up.
Well, I'm sure that's
staying in contact.
Yeah, that's a big worry, is the guilt of maybe having given it to somebody else.
Oh, absolutely. And like my mum and dad would have some underlying conditions, you know, and you're saying to yourself, oh my God, I hope I haven't infected anyone I know, you know. So every day they're ringing, I'm like, how are you feeling? Like, they were just, how are you feeling? But I was just so concerned about how they weren't showing up with any coughs or
anything.
Come here, like, you, thank God none of them did.
Have you any idea where you got it or anything? No, it's just could have been.
No anywhere. Idea. Absolutely. Yeah. Nobody in work has it. No, none of my friends or family. So I've no idea where it goes. I haven't even heard of anyone that I know that has it, you know. So, I've no idea where I came in contact with it, Willie.
Right. And did it, go on.
No, like I suppose that Sunday before I started feeling symptoms, I went down to my local pub. I had 2 points to watch a Man United match, and I came home, and the next morning I had the worst, I thought was a hangover. I was getting a stick off herself at home saying, how old are you now? 2 points and you're dying. But then the headache lasted for another 2 or 3 days. And then I said, oh, no, it's definitely not because of that. You know, so that's where I suppose where it started, you know, that first day. But again, I've been in contact with everyone that I know, and no one has it. So,
right. Astra could have been anywhere. It could have been in the supermarket off something you touched and not washed your hands, that kind of thing. Like, I mean, wherever in the Did you get a retest to be sure it's gone, or did the doctors tell you that you're immune to it now, or any kind of information like that?
No, initially in the hospital, they wanted me to test negative twice before leaving. But I did a test and it took 4 days to come back. But when I did the test during the week, I was really sick. And then 4 days later, I wasn't sick at all and it came back positive still. So they changed that. They changed the protocol to once I was 14 days and I was symptom free on the 14th day, I was good to go. So I never actually got tested negative. I never tested negative because I think the tests were taking so long to get back. They just stopped doing that and went through the protocol then of being the 14 days symptom free. And then once they told me I was allowed to leave, of course, my first question was, am I immune now? And the doctor, pretty honestly, he just said, I don't know. Because it's such a new virus that they don't know enough about it to tell you that. You should have built up the antibodies to fight it, but they don't know enough about it to say that you're definitely immune. And I still have to be careful because I can still definitely be a carrier. So you can still bring it home if I've got it on my hands or again, you know. So you just have to be as careful as everyone else.
Yeah, in the future.
So they don't know enough to tell you you're immune or not.
Right, okay. Doctors never commit to anything anyway.
No, exactly. They're cute horse. Yeah. One of my doctors in there is actually an ex-player. I'd say they're dealing with me greatly. So it was great to have a familiar face come in and have a chat to you.
Yeah.
I didn't know until I went in that was going to be one of the doctors. But it was great to have a familiar face in there.
So come here, are you strong enough to go back doing a bit of running, or are you doing a bit of training or anything like that?
Yesterday was the first bit I did out in the garden, and I was gassed after 10 minutes. But I think it's going to take a while. They say 6 to 8 weeks. I still have a slight bit of a cough and get the odd headache, but I think it's like 6 to 8 weeks before it might clear your system. So I definitely, my legs were like jelly for the first 2 weeks. So yesterday was the first day I thought to myself, well, I'll do a bit here. And I couldn't do too much, to be honest. But I went back to work last weekend, and that was great to get back. And I was on the ambulance straight away then. So now I was on the other side of it. I was getting all the gowned up and face masks going into other people's houses. So you know what they're going through, the fear and all, because I've been through it. So it does help.
Yeah, definitely does. Come here, Michael. Thanks very much. I won't keep you any longer. Thanks for sharing all that stuff with us.
Well, no problem at all. It's great to talk to you.
Good stuff from Michael there, lads. It's like, I can only imagine being in a hospital bed, being sicker than you've ever been in your whole life, being completely on your own, no family. You know, if you get a flu in really high temperature, you need a little bit of kind of reassurance you're going to be all right from your mother usually. Like, I'm thinking back to when I was really sick. It's always my mother looking after me. But you're completely on your own. You're in a hotel or you're in a hospital room. Nurses come in almost like they're in outer space with covers and everything. And they spend, you know, as little time in there as you can. And you, all these kind of thoughts going through your head, you can't see anybody, you know, Conan. Like, I mean, it's absolutely horrific. And the scary thing about it is there's old people dying in that scenario.
Mm. Yeah, we did a video with Irish rugby women's player, Claire McLaughlin. She's a doctor in Belfast. And she was going on about, like, part of her shift is being a bouncer, basically, at the door, where if somebody has symptoms of coronavirus, and they have to go in themselves and the family have to stay away. And she said, like, sometimes you're telling people this could be the last time you see them, like, you know, because they're going to be in bed themselves, being sick themselves, and you can't come in and visit them. It's absolutely horrific. Like, and just like it's good to hear Johnny Glynn sort of give that little description as well, because Marion McGuinness used to play of Armagh Ladies. She was talking about waking up and feeling really sore and tired as if she just played a big match the day before, you know, and having those aches and stuff like that. It's a really scary time, especially I'd say for Johnny then, who's out in America as well, which is obviously a lot more severe.
Yeah, when you kind of be on your own away from family as well. But the question I'm always curious about, and I know, Conor, you're not going to have the answer to this, but like, I mean, the idea that somebody would die without any family members near them, could the family member not just use some of the protective equipment in the hospital, go in and hold their mother or father's hand while they pass away, rather than, like, I mean, if nurses can go in and doctors, like, I'm sure you could sign the consent form and say, look, I'm going to wear the protective gear. If I get it, I'm going to take that risk and go in and hold their hand. I think it's inhumane what's happening to people dying without anybody being in there with them.
You'd like to think that something like that could happen, because like just some of the stories that are coming out of it, coming out of this whole thing, are absolutely heartbreaking. Whether it's, you know, people who have close relatives, mothers and fathers and friends that have died, they can't go to the funeral. Only a few people can attend funeral. Like Michael said, being in hospital there for a couple of weeks. I mean, like, Michael recovered and he's a young person, but as you said earlier on, if you're an older person and the fear and the anxiety that would strike in you, you know, just having to wait on your own and not being able to talk about, you know, talk to a family or just confide in a friend or something like that. And like, I think it's important to hear those stories as well, because I think we're in danger of becoming immune to the figures that come out every day. I mean, it's just accepted as a matter of fact now when you hear that there was 40 deaths or something like that and hundreds more confirmed cases. And we just come to accept it as part of the daily news cycle, whereas a story like that and even Michael's experience just reminds you of the mechanics and how horrible this virus can be for the people who are suffering and for their immediate family and friends as well.
Yeah, no, definitely. But I definitely think something needs to be done about the people dying alone when there's protective gear. And if it's okay for nurses to go in, how can a child of an elderly person not go in, you know, using gloves and the screen and all that? I don't get it. But anyways, lads, Conor McKeown had it in the Herald that Conall Keeney and Stephen Cluxton are set to play this year. That's, of course, if there's ever is a championship this year. Cluxton's 39 this year. So if there's no GAA this year, you know, these lads could actually end up retiring on a year where they didn't really even play. But Cluxton will be 40 next year. He's 39 this year. But it's incredible that they're committing again. And we know Stephen Cluxton's a bit of a freak, but let's be honest, he's a goalkeeper. And goalkeepers don't run all that much. And we know Cluxton is an unusual goalkeeper in that he has himself in the kind of shape, you know, a lot of outfield players have. They're both on the go since 2001. They started a week apart. So for context, with Cluxton, Ross Munley and Niall McNamee are the closest to him. They started in 2003. They're both outfield players. McNamee's still on the team. Munley's on and off. McNamee's still on the Division 3 team. Munley is on and off the Laois team. David Clark, we know, started in a setup in 2001. He didn't make his debut until 2005. So he doesn't really seem to be kind of thrown into that same list. But the context for Conall Keeney, I find incredible. Conall Keeney, the next oldest to Conall Keeney is Anthony Nash, who's 36. He's 2 years younger. Keeney's 38. After that, it's Alan Nolan, who's 35. Nash and Nolan, obviously, are goalkeepers. The closest outfield player is Owen Cadogan, who's 34. So Keeney's 38. Cadogan started in 2007. Keeney started in 2001, right? Waterford's Kevin Moran. So Kevin Moran, like, is 33. Like, you know, it feels like he's around forever and is a real stalwart. He started in the summer of 06. Conal Keeley started in 2001. And he's still playing outfield for Dublin. And in last year's championship, he was their outstanding forward. He's a freak of nature, Conal Keeley. He's another one of our own here on the GAR. The sooner he finishes up, we'll be able to get him back. But that's, Conan, that's freakish stuff from both of them. But I would say more so Conal Keeley.
It's phenomenal, like, and probably more so Conal Keeney in different levels, because, like, performance wise, obviously, like, yeah, you're outfield, you're taking hits, you're trying to get your body to be able to play senior hurling every week. But then, like we talked before, like, you talked about how Cluxton's life is set up perfectly because he's a primary school teacher and he can go down to training early. But I think that's the hardest thing for going that long is committing to all that training and all the studying the tapes and the text messages and eating right. And, like, you're just living your life to be ready for a game on a Sunday. I can't get my head around how you could be doing that from 2001. It's stupid stuff, to be honest. Like, and the fact that these two are doing it at the highest level is just, I don't know, I'm actually speechless about it.
Just one thing to say on Conal Keeney as well, Woolley, is that, like, some of the players you mentioned there, you know, Ross Munley, Niall McNamee, kind of corner forwards, more slip of fellas that mightn't be getting involved in the thick of the action. The one word that comes to mind for me for Conal Keeney would be that he's a warrior. So he's constantly taking belts. He's constantly kind of getting involved in, you know, he's like getting involved in, like, the physical aspect of the game. And not only that, he's played inter-county football for Dublin, inter-county hurling for Dublin. Both codes at club level, and with both with Ballyboden at hurling and football, has had, you know, huge long campaigns that have stretched into the winter and through Christmas, you know, like, in both codes. So for that amount of durability, and that, like, he's had a fair few injuries as well, and pretty serious crash at one stage of his career as well. So for that durability and to be still playing at the age he is, I think is absolutely astounding.
Yeah, it's a good year though to commit, because you're only going to have a few weeks of training.
Lads could be coming out of retirement, but I always remember Conal Keeney, like, he's such a competitor. He's a competitor. I've played against him, and he's not on the field to make friends. He's on the field to win, you know. And I like those kind of attitudes. But I remember we did that thing on Sports Joe Live with the how hard kicking the ball, and he did it one time, and we're across doing it, and he kicks it a couple of times. He's just wearing runners, and he wasn't happy with the result, and he says, "Here, I've got AstroTurf boots in my car. Will you give me another go with them?" So he goes sprinting like a young lad going off to get his boots. He goes running out of the place we were doing it, sprinting off to his car, lands back out of breath with the better shoes, and absolutely rockets it into the net, like, gets a record from it. Like, you know, I just thought it was funny, just a joke game. He was like, okay, I can actually do better than this if I have decent runners on me.
That's amazing. Like, just the enthusiasm for that and the confidence to know that he could do better as well.
Clear, another thing in that piece, Conan, I couldn't believe was Stephen Cluxton. Like, I mean, I know you're obsessed with players that didn't play a minor. In 1999, Cluxton was with the Dublin Minors. He was third choice behind Vinnie Galvin and Aina O'Reilly. He was third choice goalkeeper for the Miners in 1999. This is incredible stuff. How was he goalkeeper on your team that never played minor?
He better have been.
I don't know if he was.
Maybe he was minor again the next year or something. I'd be surprised if he never played it. But that in 1999 anyway, he was third choice, and he was obviously second choice behind Davy Byrne until for a couple of years as well.
You know, I was obsessed with these players who never played minor for about 10 years until I finally gave up on my dream of playing at the county level. So I was always kidding myself. It's like, look, Bernard Brogan didn't do it. Maybe I'll get the call someday.
Okay, so there was a selfish motivation behind this.
Dermot Murphy from Kerry, who was in goals. So that's not a bad one either, but Cluxton would have been better, all right.
Yeah, no, he definitely would. Oisín McConville, right? So we did the Armagh 2002 win. Was it me and you, Conor, or Conan? I can't remember.
You
did that one with me, and we were talking about Oisín missing the penalty before half time and how devastated he looked and putting his hands up to his head and stuff like that. And he was talking about it in the Irish News this week. And he said, I wasn't able to brush it off fairly quickly. And before I read the quote, we were saying this, that it was unusual to see a player look so devastated, you know, with the sports psychology of brushing it off. And McConville said, no, he was asked about this anyways. And he said, no, I wasn't able to brush it off fairly quickly. I was glad I got to half time. I remember nobody really said anything to me. The only person that did was Ronan Clark, slapped me on the back of my head and said, you'll get a goal in the second half. And he was only 19 at the time. He said, a few boys came over and hit me on the top of the head or slapped me on the back. They didn't say a whole lot. There wasn't a lot to be said about the penalty. People just presumed I'd deal with it myself. And I suppose before going on any further, that is kind of how people deal with it. Like, I mean, you're not going to gather around and say, like, lads have more important things to worry than consoling a fella who missed the penalty. In a lot of ways, the teammates would probably be half tick with him anyways that he missed it. And he's bit like, I've never seen a dressing room where something like that is dealt with. I don't know about either of you, other than the player just having to suck it up and go out in the second half.
No, exactly. And like at that stage, Oisín McConville is how long in the Armagh team at that stage, one of their main forwards. Like, you know, they would have trusted him at that stage to be able to get over it, to be able to deal with himself. And obviously he did. But I just thought that was brilliant by Ronan Clark, considering that he's only 19 at the time. We gladly gave him, I think we awarded him man of the match fully for his contribution, like on the field. And just to have that kind of, I think if Oisín McConville was telling that story and he said that, oh, Kieran McGeaney came up to me at halftime, slapped me in the back of the head, you know, and told me I'd get a goal in the second half, a far bigger deal would have been made of it. And so, like, for Ronan Clark to be able to do that, as well as, like, you know, deliver a performance that should have got him man the match in the day, I think says a lot about him. But he dressed himself down. He hadn't had a good, like, I think he got man the match in the end, even though he didn't have a great first half and wasn't really in it until he got the goal in the second half. But that's like, they were obviously just right to trust him to kind of get over it himself.
Yeah, no, and he was well able to get over it. But I thought another interesting thing he said was that we had two sports psychologists. I'm not going to name them now, but there were sports psychologists back in 2002. He said, with us at the time, and they told me to go out after half time, take a ball with me and stick it into the net at Hill 16. I said, right. As I was running down the tunnel with the ball, I thought, this is going to look fucking stupid. So when I came out, I just wellied the ball as far as I could down the field. Maybe that's what it was about, just one way of letting it out of my system. And it just, like, I mean, these were sports psychologists back a long time ago, but it was a very gimmicky kind of stuff back then. Like, I mean, this is an All-Ireland final, you've just missed a penalty. Really, really, is this going to change anything in your head by kicking the ball into an empty net at the Hill, Conor? Like that, for me, I think sports psychology back then had a lot of kind of gimmicks like that.
Yeah, and I suppose you're probably a lot more false prophets. Not that they were, but, like, you know, there's a lot, maybe not as accredited as you have to be nowadays to work with a county team. But to be honest, I can see the value in it as well. Just seeing the net rippling, like, where he might start seeing the goals a bit smaller, the goalkeeper standing in his way, you know, there might be a mental block there. He didn't need it, obviously, so there probably is a bit of a bullshit attached to it. But yeah, even the fact that he saw the value in getting something out of his system, and that even all these years later he was still sort of hung up on missing that penalty. And it's like every best performance you see, people make a mistake in the game, but they don't let it consume them. Like, and they know that these little things, they aren't the winning and losing of a match. Like, it's the overall 70 minutes, and like that's the important thing. And whatever way you can get to that, I think that's where the psychology comes in. Maybe it's not kicking the ball into an empty net.
Yeah, well, you see, this is the reason I'm kind of thinking of this, and I've told this story on the show before. It was 2005 or 2006, and Dublin had just hammered us in a Leinster semi-final, and we had a sports psychologist with us that was apparently was highly rated at the time, and he was with the Cork Hurlers and stuff like that. And he came up and he got us in the dressing room before we went out training on the Tuesday night after the hammering, and he told us to write down all the things we thought was wrong about the performance and the preparation and all that. So, like, I mean, we all got a pen and a piece of paper each, and I was scribbling down, absolutely attacking the management. I was on the bench. They weren't picking me. So I had no shortage of material. The whole thing's a joke, I was saying. They were not, you know, whatever. And so then he told us to put all our negative feelings and thoughts into a bucket in the middle of the dressing room. So all this was the negative stuff, and we put all that into the bucket. And then he picked up the bucket and said, follow me. So we all followed him, and he walked out into the middle of the pitch in a Moor Park and put the bucket on the ground and set all the pieces of paper on fire in it, So we had a little fire of all the negativity, and now we're going to focus and work forward from that. Now, look, on a very, very basic level, you can see where it's coming from, but we were giggling kind of. Like, I remember, you know, when my attitude was all wrong that year, but I don't know. I just thought, again, that was a little bit gimmicky as well.
So did nobody get to read that then, Willie? So all
nobody got to read it, no. And I was hoping that these were anonymous because we were told not to put our names to it. So I was like, oh, lovely. I'm really going to town on this feedback now. And like, I mean, this was just all the negativity was to be put away and burned.
But isn't it interesting? Like, yeah, it's the gimmicks that are all wrong. Like, and they're the things that you remember, and they're the things that are obviously the worst. Like, if you went to a psychologist about your mental health, like, they wouldn't give you a line and say, right, away you go, now you're going to be granted. It's like, not to sound like Jim Gavin, but like when you listen to Declan Dursley speaking, when you chatted to him, it was all about a process and stuff which is done over time, and it started becoming natural into their way of thinking. Like, you know, you can't just set up how to things on fire. You were probably thinking, I made a lot of good points there that I want to raise. Yeah.
No, but this was the thing. If I was the manager, I would be like, this is like gold dust. I'm going to read every single one of these and I'm going to learn from it, because player feedback is very important. And if there was a common theme amongst all 30 of them, well, that's definitely feedback. They just burned all this information. Like, I mean, like, if you were to tell Jim Gavin that I'm going to give you all this really good information from the players and go out and burn it, he'd be like, are you off your head? I want that information.
Remember Eamon Burns?
Did it have any sort of desired effect? What happened next?
Oh no, we got a run in the qualifiers. Like, I mean, I think this is completely independent of this. I don't know. We got a run in the qualifiers. We actually beat Tyrone next at home in Portlaoise, would you believe?
Well, it worked. What can you say?
Maybe the gimmick worked. Yeah, I never actually thought about all of my criticisms. What happened next? Just on that topic, I missed that Caroline Curitt is back with the Limerick Hurlers for 2020. See, she wouldn't be into gimmicks like that, you know. Like, I think sports psychology has moved on. I'd say she would call herself more as a performance consultant. Like, and she will, like, Paul O'Connell had her, and he's not burning negative thoughts or anything like that, or he's not kicking a conversion in front of the goals to tell him he can kick conversions. Like, it's about preparing properly, the mental and actual, like, you know, time in your day, separating it, having a life outside of the sport, you know, organizing your life, understanding the value of what you're doing. You know, like, I think sports psychology has moved away from that potentially gimmicky stuff back then to more practical stuff. Like, I would be more interested in what she would be able to do, you know, rather than some of the lads that were. Then again, look, we're nearly 20 years on and it's all evolving, Conor.
Yeah, like, there definitely is a lot of value. And I remember an interview of Kevin McMenamin, obviously he's big into it, and he made a really good point. Like, you know, when you talk about the teams who win championships, we're never really talking about them being stronger or fitter. Very little times that we do that. We talk about how they manage to cope under pressure. We always talk about Dublin coming back from adversity, you know, and continuing to go. Like, and again, it's not a gimmick that lets that happen. Like, you know, it's a process over time, and like, it obviously has evolved over time to get to that stage where it's, you know, people who are working with them day in, day out, the same way a strength and conditioning coach would do it. Like, even if you do, like, I think there's a lot of mental strength involved in strength and conditioning. I think Mikko would always say that's what he did the run for with Leash and with Kildare and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just, and like, you know yourself, like, you know, if you're out doing a long run, in your head you're thinking, I need to stop here. When in reality, you could probably go on for another 3 or 4K. Like, you know, but the fitter you get, then the more mentally strong you get as well. So it all works in tandem.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. There's loads of different strands to it. But I want to finish up with this one, because I was tweeting about this. The GA Joe was tweeting about the worst football drill ever in Gaelic football. This is more of a Gaelic football one, because I couldn't imagine it transferring to hurling. But it's the square. It's the two lads in the middle of the square and four lads outside it, and you have to pass to the four lads outside it while being, let's be honest, absolutely mauled by a fella inside, because there's absolutely no policing or no proper tackling. It's just anything goes in there, and you're allowed to get absolutely destroyed in there. And depending how cruel the manager is, this could last 30 seconds, it could last 45 seconds, it could last a minute. Generally, the groups are split into four or five different groups, so the manager will take a wander, so you're able to kind of watch him out of the corner of your eye and see, has he gone to another group, and at least you can calm down a little bit on it then. But it's an absolute torturous drill that nobody likes, outside of maybe a real dogging corner back Conan that might be in his element.
Yeah, you call it the square. I think it's the square of death is what it should be called. Like it's thankless. Like, and especially like you do it a lot over pre-season, like so on a boggy ground and you're slipping everywhere. And as you say, it's not even that there's no policing. It's that the defender is encouraged to just hammer him. Like that's what they want to see, and that's the positive reinforcement you hear. Then it's like, good lad, like get stuck onto him, and you're just being pelted. The person who's the worst though in this drill is not the defender. It's the person who wins the ball and gives it straight back to the person who got the ball off. Like, it's just cheating. You're supposed to try and take it past him and give it to another player who's free. But yeah, that's always a real stickener for the defender. But yeah.
I don't know. Willie, I think I told the story before, but Jim McGuinness took our club for training once. It was the year before he took over Donegal, and he extended that square to about 30 metres by 30 metres. So there was about five or six, you know, pairs in the middle, right? And then everybody else was on the outside. So he won the ball, he had to pop it off to somebody else. But he extended the length of time to 3 minutes, right?
Oh, God.
Well, as well as that, if you were spotted fouling, there was a punishment at the end. So he'd count up the number of fouls that he counted. And of course, after 45 seconds, people are just absolutely shattered and they're fouling left, right and centre. So at the end of it, after 3 minutes of torture, he calls us in and he goes, well, I spotted six fouls there, the 10 push-ups per foul. So we had to do 60 push-ups at the end of it then. So it's by far the most excruciating experience I've ever had in the training pit.
Jesus, I think all the worst or the least favourite football drills were involving hand passing. Like, I mean, is that truck and trailer stupid one that put my head in where it's complicated. And for me, it's completely like not practical for Gaelic football. It's just a complicated drill that... Like, I mean, I've done it at intermediate level and it took us like about 10 minutes to get it right. And then the manager was so happy that we eventually got it right. We did it for like another 15 minutes. Go on, you have it now and you're flying at it. And it's like you pass it to someone running past you and you just run straight ahead to another cone and wait there. And you end up just, I suppose, following the person in front of you and never really looking past that Colin.
Yeah, that happens in a lot of drills. Like, it's just like, where am I going? So you ask the person in front of you, where am I going? And you don't even worry about what's happening in the drill.
Yeah,
you fall and you fall with that person, and you ask the next person to come, where are we going? Like, you know, if managers can know that. But you're right, that's what happens in truck and trailer. As soon as they see a groove, it probably looks good on the outside.
Yeah.
They get all excited, they add in an extra ball. And then after 10 minutes of doing that, they tell you, we're going to go the other way now. That's the exact same drill.
No, the other one is the three-man weave, Connor. Like, I mean, this is like one of the most famous ones all over the country. And to be honest, it's pointless, the three-man weave. It's another silly one that doesn't really relate to a match situation other than managers just do it. It seems like it's a warm-up thing and you're going across and it's all grand and you pan pass it off. I always wondered about the three-man weave, why managers wouldn't do it, say, with the full back line on the end line in their positions and say, now I want you doing the three-man weave and try and say, right, when we're breaking out with the ball, I want that support, you know, a bit of support play coming either side of the man and at least making the three-man weave in some way relevant to a game other than it just being a kind of a warm-up drill that is completely irrelevant.
Yeah, I think that's it. This goes back to truck and trailer as well. I think the three-man weave, when it works as it's supposed to, looks good.
You
know, everybody's shouting their name. Everybody's kind of, you know, letting the man that has the ball before them know that they're there for the support run. But the problem is that there's rarely any defenders put in the way. So it's not practical in terms of the game, because when you have any amount of space in front of you, you can make any support run, because there's nobody standing there. There's nobody going to get in your way. There's no tackles being put in. And that's why the three-man weave is far different from the when you get three men attacking a goal with a couple of defenders, which obviously has practical implications and is obviously being put into practice because, you know, when people are kind of practicing goals and maybe palming it over the defender and palming it into the net. But it all comes back to what, like, I think managers get a big kick out of something that looks good. And it's nearly as if they think that if there was some invigilator and some analysis coming to look at training, they say, geez, look at them, they're all in motion, they're all doing the three-man weave, they're all calling names. And that making things look good is important as practical implications on the pitch.
Yeah, no, like, I mean, that's it. And like, you know, the big square kick pass, I always like kick passing drills. I didn't care what one it was, because you're at least kick passing and you're running a decent distance and you're getting well warmed up. And like the square where you receive a kick pass and you hand pass it to a lad running past you, and then you go to his hand pass position, and then you're the next one kicking it, and it's a square. and then the manager will tell you to go the other way, so you're practicing both your left and right. I like that, because there's actually, you're improving as a footballer, you're getting fitter, you're using both feet, and you're kicking 20 metres. Why can't all drills, Conor, not be nonsense like truck and trailer, three-man weave, that stupid square? Well, I can see the practicality of the square, it's just dogging you and getting you fit. But like, it's very rare that you're going to be tackled like that for 30 seconds without releasing the ball or being fouled. You know, that's just a cruel one, that square of death. But like, I mean, there's some of the kick passing ones at least have value to them.
But that kick passing, when you're talking about the square, actually, that brings in the only really good element from the three-man weave and truck and trailer, which is the timing and the run off the shoulder and the angle of the run. So you can do that with the kick passing square. You just have a man you're popping with it in, like, because you can see when you do truck and trailer, sometimes it's valuable because a lot of lads are just 10 meters ahead of the ball and they're turning around to get it. And that's the one coaching point that you bring into it, like, you know, time the run, get off the shoulder at the right time. You can do that with that kick passing drill. They're like one of the worst things that I hate, and it, you know, there's like that. I think that square, the square of death is valuable, but I hate it, like, because a couple of months down the line, then, and you're training and boys are fouling, and then the manager starts suddenly saying, "Stop fouling." And you're like, "Well, that's all we were doing in training." But it's the one where you have to hand pass the ball five times before you can shoot or something, like, you know.
Oh, that nonsense.
That's
nonsense.
That's again just an all-out battering session, and then like you don't need to mark the man with the ball because he can't shoot, so you just go to everybody else and hold them, like, you know.
Yeah,
there's a lot of fouling.
I do find, you know, like the three forwards versus two defenders, and you see Dublin doing that an awful lot. But I find that gets so predictable that the defenders just drop off so far that, you know, they know what's coming. Do you get me? Like, I mean, the defenders don't make an honest effort like they would in a game. They just know it's a three versus two. So they're just backing off, and they're not committing to the hand pass to let somebody through.
Yeah, we've done a variation of that where there might be two defenders, but the first defender can't go like inside the 21, for example, so they can't drop off. They have to confront, say, if the three forwards are running from maybe the 50 or beyond, that the first defender has to try and at least confront them around the 45, just to give them the decision to make, and just to ask the defender to commit as opposed to being happy to drop off. And then just a lot of defenders in those drills, if you do it the way that you're talking about there, are just happy to concede a point, because the whole purpose of the drill is to try and score a goal. But one drill that I want to mention that we've done that I find kind of interesting is if you get like an underage goalpost, for example, and you split teams into two, so you've forwards and backs on one side of the goal and forwards and backs on the other side of the goal, and there's a D, like a semicircle drawn around the goal from either side, so you can kick points from either side, and then you have to kick from outside the D, let's say the semicircle. You get a point if you score, but if your teammate on the other side wins the ball cleanly, it's 2 points, and then you have to work it outside the D as well. So everybody's kind of doing something. You know, you ideally you try to isolate your shooter to shoot outside the D, but other people can do it too. Defenders have to tackle, and you're all in front of the goal trying to win the ball as well. So it's an enjoyable one.
I have to say, I don't like that one, Conor. I don't want to dispute it. Like, I mean, whatever happened to backs and forwards? Does anyone do? Am I showing my age by saying, can we not have a good game of backs and forwards?
You see, people are too clever now. Backs and forwards shy for the backs because
it is shy for the backs. Yeah, that's why it's great.
Yeah, like they're starting on the 45 with no pressure. It's like this never happens in a game. They get a free pass, and then as soon as you score, there's always some asshole who's lingering around the 45 just to get another ball and bring it straight back in. And you know, everybody spread out. Like they need to, if you're going to do backs and forwards, it needs to go further out, and there needs to be 10 seconds.
Pressure on the ball.
The ball should come from a half back line or whatever. But one thing that we used to absolutely do my head in about the backs and forwards was when a manager would just randomly say, right, switch it around now, the backs are playing. And I'm like, what are you talking about? What benefit is a corner back now playing corner forward? Like, I mean, do you remember that going on? Like, if we used to tear my hair out, I used to just stop trying. I'd be like, this is a joke. What are we doing here? Why are the backs now becoming forwards? What's the thought process on this? And then as it kind of evolved a little bit, at least it changed to two kind of, you know, cones outside, so the backs actually had to work it out if they won it back. And I could live with that because at least we're practicing stopping them coming out. But the idea that the backs just automatically turn into forwards is absolutely an outrageous thing to do.
Yeah, but the drills only lasted for 2 minutes when the backs used to do, because none of the forwards used to try anyway. So it was to try and give us a break, but it never worked.
Yeah, no, listen, it has. I remember one time we did a drill with Portlaoise. I won't say who the management was. We did a drill with Portlaoise for about 45 minutes. They were over talking. And they started us off doing a drill, and it was, you know, that drill where half the team's down one end, half the other end, and there's one player standing in front of one group. You hand pass it to him, he hand passes it back, then you kick it up to the other group. You know that one? Yeah. And then you join the other group. It's like monotonous and it's fairly boring. At least there's kick passing and running in it, which I didn't mind. I'd say we did it for 45 minutes. And they were over talking and we were getting tick. And every now and then they would shout over, go on, rise it up now. There, come on, there's not much intensity now. And would you believe when we finished that drill? All right, lads, warm down there now. That was the training session. One poxy drill. I should name them, but I've been critical enough of them in the past. So there's your clue. Right, listen, boys, we'll leave it there. You could talk about drills all day, actually. There's so many stupid ones out there. But I think I'm getting a little bit old in that I haven't been around teams long enough to know if they've evolved or what the hell's going on or not now. So maybe all the old stocks are still there, Colin. You're still playing there. Are all the old stock drills still going, or is there all new ones?
They're still going. Like, you talk about three-man weave there, but I actually think we've got a good variation of it now where it's like you have the, you know, the soccer things that they use for free kicks, the sort of, what do you call them?
Yeah.
The things that they're still, statues, like, we have those sort of planted, and it's like four or five boys. You have to sort of just make those runs. Like, it's not like a three-man weave, but you have to get those runs off the shoulder in between those mannequins, and then just have a shot at goal. Like, so there's probably a lot more sense. There's a lot more purpose, I find, with the stuff that you're doing nowadays. Like, you know,
right? Because players are getting smarter, I suppose. And like, I do love the idea of angled support runs, just not in close proximity like the three-man weave, which makes. Yeah. Anyways, we're going to get back into the three-man weave. We'll leave it there. We'll be back on Monday and we'll do a couple more nostalgia shows. So we'll talk to you then. Good luck.
And when I started running, I suppose I didn't stop. And when I got the chance to go, I said I'd stay going. So it opened up.
We're only the small little fish out there, so we are. And we're trying hard to make it through. But it's hard to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.
Because I love this county so much, you know, and it's just, I'm delighted that the lads did it for the people of Waterford today, because, like, I'm heartbroken. I let it go, 'cause I never see you later, but not a lot of talking out.